Again, I am Wade Ivey, and today I'll be discussing, as she stated, an assessment of respondent-driven sampling based upon essentially the data that Martin presented just earlier. And first, I would like to start off by going over a few of the common strategies for sampling hidden and hard-to-reach populations. Just briefly, one of the most traditional, most well-known methods is snowball sampling, which identifies a number of subgroup members who act as seeds by providing information on other subgroup members to be included into the sample. And since this is not a probability sample, the drawback of snowball sampling is sampling bias, essentially. Even though the seeds are, in theory, chosen randomly, in practice this is very hard to accomplish. And generally there is no limit to the number of seeds that one can, number of recruits that a seed can recruit. So the snowball sample is oftentimes biased by those who have larger networks. Also, there's facility-based sampling, which samples population members from specific facilities such as correctional facilities, STD clinics, or drug treatment clinics. And the sampling at drug treatment clinics, for example, will restrict your sample to those who seek treatment, which is dependent upon the availability, accessibility, knowledge of that facility, and the will to seek treatment of the individual. And quickly, target sampling extends the ideas of snowball sampling, which includes an ethnographic assessment to identify various networks. And then there's time-location sampling, which identifies locations of hard-to-reach populations where they congregate, and this allows for sampling through that sampling frame. However, it misses those individuals who do not frequent those places. So, for respondent-driven sampling, briefly, it is similar to snowball sampling in that it relies on chain referral, as Martin stated. However, they differ in that, unlike snowball sampling, RDS limits the number of people one individual can recruit. And the recruitment process is implemented in such a way that allows for the calculation of selection probabilities, thus qualifying the sample as a probability sampling method. And The information on network size is also gathered to weigh the analysis of post stratification to compensate for oversampling in the event that we do have oversampling. So, I am, as Martin stated, I am from the University of Illinois Chicago, one of the four sites participating in SAFCAP, which I will go state again, the Sexual Acquisition and Transmission of HIV. RAND is our coordinating corporation, and the Research Triangle at Raleigh-Durham, the University of California at LA, and Yale University are other partners. So first I'd like to go over a bit of the protocol, the SAFCAP protocol for the Chicago site, and I'll first talk about the eligibility criteria. For an individual to be included, in the past 6 months they must have used hard drugs, which we classify as powder or crack cocaine, heroin, or methamphetamine, regardless of the mode of administration. Also, men who have sex with men are eligible, and sex partners of those two groups and sex partners of sex partners are also eligible for the study. So in order to recruit individuals, we offer coupons to the individuals, to participants in the study. And these coupons are used to recruit different types of individuals, which is one of the advantages of RDS. And for our study in Chicago, drug users and men who have sex with men were given a total of 6 coupons, 3 of them being for drug users and men who have sex with men. Two of the coupons were for sex partners, regardless of their drug use, and 1 coupon was also given to men for their non-drug using female sex partners. As a special interest group, we wanted to see if we could capture those individuals, those women as well, to see if they were at greatly increased risk. And sex partners of drug users, or MSMs, were given 3 coupons to recruit their sex partners, and sex partners of sex partners were not given coupons. So the coupons are color-coded for the participant to be able to identify to whom they should be given. And this helps the participants know what they should be doing with the coupons. They are given the opportunity to call back into the study or come back in if they have any questions about those coupons. And when a person enters into the study, they are screened, which I'll talk about in a second. But they're reimbursed, as Martin said earlier, three different ways. For the initial interview, which is done on an ACASI system, which is automated computer-assisted self-interview, which ensures that their information is confidential, and it will, I think it eases our population, because we have a population, as we said, of drug users, of men who have sex with men and women who are very protective of their information. So the ACASI system is very important to our data collection. And the individuals are reimbursed for that initial interview. They're reimbursed for the recruits that they screen eligible, and they're also reimbursed for coupon review in Chicago. So one of the very important aspects of the RDS is the screening process, because in a study such as this, individuals will in a very poor neighborhoods where our studies are located, individuals will do oftentimes what they need to do to get into the study. So if that be lie, they'll do that. So the screening process is very very important. And for us, we have, as I said, the coupons, which are which have serial numbers for tracking, and we have a tracking system that allows us to determine who we gave those coupons to, who these individuals gave the coupons to, and that assists and aids us in being able to identify duplicates and false claims. The coupons are restricted, time restricted, so that a person cannot use a coupon before 24 hours after being given the coupon, which prevents them from exiting the study site and finding the first person on the street saying, "Hey, go into the study, tell them this, and so I can get paid essentially immediately." And the coupon expires after 30 days, which encourages individuals to go out and recruit other individuals. So when a person is screened eligible or ineligible for the study, based upon the information that they give us, we tell them, "I'm sorry that you screened ineligible. However, you can, if you get another coupon, come back and try again under another coupon from another person," because, again, these are networks. And so we do that. We don't tell them specifically why, because we want to reduce coaching, essentially. So we don't want individuals to understand too much, so they go out and say, "Well, I know I need to say this to get into the study." So the screening process is very, very critical. As you can see, the map here is a map of Chicago, and we have three study sites in Chicago, and this is a map of the Wave 1 data for SAFCAP. And as you can see, three sites, one in South Chicago, one in Uptown, and one in Humboldt Park, where we have three locations, and the data are concentrated at those locations. However, we are collecting data throughout the city of Chicago, as you can see. Here are just a few pictures of our field stations and our staff. This is the Southeast Side Field Station. This is a neighborhood that is predominantly African American with a large population of Hispanics as well. This is our Humboldt Park Field Station and staff. And this is a primarily Hispanic neighborhood. And this is our Uptown Field Station, which is primarily a white a very mixed neighborhood, but with a large proportion of whites. And so for SAFCAP, we started with six seeds, which produced 1,062 recruits. And this is a diagram, as Martin showed earlier, of the Wave 1 recruitment tree based upon the color of coupon that the individual was entered into the study upon. The blues representing those drug-using individuals or men who have sex with men. The greens are the sex partners of those individuals. The yellow are sex partners of sex partners. And the pinks are those non-drug-using female sex partners of men. The squares are men, the circles are women. And the red are the seeds. The seeds that you can see here. These are three distinct recruitment chains. This is the first and the second here in this top right-hand corner, which is started by this seed. And this third recruitment chain here started by this seed. And as you can see, through RDS, we were able to get these long recruitment chains with in essence, because we were limiting the number of coupons that we were giving the individuals. So the sample demographics for our Chicago data, our total N was 1,068, of which 61% were male. The vast majority were African American at 72%. 85% of them used hard drugs in the previous 30 days, and 28% reported injection drug use in the previous 30 days. And 14% of our sample were men who have sex with men, based on the previous 6 months. And our sample was a very low-income sample, with 90% of it earning less than $1,000 in the previous month. And our mean age was 44 years, which is an older population. So one of the benefits of RDS is its ability to capture hidden populations, as we stated. And one of the interesting things we found in SAFCAP using RDS in the ACASI is that men who reported having sex with men in the previous 6 months, 75% of them also reported having sex with women in the previous 6 months. And we thought this was interesting to see how these behaviors and their sexual identities compare. So as you can see on the left-hand side of the slide, we have sex partners, which is essentially their sexual behavior compared with their sexual identity. And for the men who stated in the previous 6 months that they had male and female sex partners, 79% of them reported that they identified as being bisexual. 22% reported that they, of men who had only female partners reported being bisexual, and of the men who only had male sex partners, 44% reported being bisexual. So, for men who have sex with men and women, are a prime group in terms of HIV intervention, especially for African Americans. And using RDS in combination with ACASI is an ability that we can find these individuals in terms of HIV treatment or interventions and prevention programs. One of the other benefits of RDS is that you're able to assess biases in your sample. And one of these biases when collecting data in this manner is the varying levels of in-group recruitment, which is essentially your homophily level. Homophily is a measure of in-group recruitment. And as you can see in this cross-gender sample recruitment slide, men in our sample recruited another man 62% of the time, and females recruited another female 40% of the time. And as for the homophily, in other words, tells you that how likely an individual, a group, recruits within that same group. So the homophily here means that recruitment took place as if there were random mixing in the subpopulation of gender. And since, however, we did see for males that the negative homophily there implies that the men were more likely to be recruited by a female, but it's still close to zero, so it was basically random mixing along gender. And the same group, the same table here for across race. As you can see, whites recruited another white 29% of the time, blacks 91% of the time recruited other blacks, and Hispanics recruited another Hispanic 69% of the time. And what's interesting to see here is that we're not seeing any in-group bias for gender. We are seeing some along race, where the homophily level here is at about 62% for black individuals and 63% for Hispanics, where it was lower for whites. In terms of behavior, the slide here is essentially heterosexual men at the top, men who have sex with men, men who are sexually inactive, and women in the previous 6 months. And as you can see, 36% of heterosexual men recruit another heterosexual man. But the interesting thing here is that among men who have sex with men, we see a high degree of homophily, which, therefore, when we calculate prevalence estimates using this sample, we can see that men who have sex with men have a high homophily, and this is important because it tells us that we're oversampling men who have sex with men, so therefore we can adjust for that homophily more accurately to create more accurate and unbiased prevalence estimates. As for cross HIV status sample recruitment, essentially what we were seeing is that HIV positives were not highly clustered, with a homophily of around 3%, which may or may not have implications of bridging to other populations. We don't know that just yet, but it's interesting to see. And the homophily was low, essentially, for both of those groups. And the adjusting mean network size also, we haven't found any major differences in those as well. So in RDS, if the chain referral process consists of enough waves or cycles of recruitment, the composition of the final sample is independent of the seeds from which they were gathered. And this figure illustrates the process by which our sample approached equilibrium based upon HIV status. So this, as you can see, is the it illustrates wave by wave the initial recruits had all the initial recruits been HIV positive. So the triangle, green triangle, starts at 100% for HIV positive, but after about three waves, we see that the sample stabilizes at about 88% for HIV negatives and about 12% for HIV positives. So some of the difficulties that we are experiencing with RDS, as Martin stated earlier, was cross-income recruitment. We're seeing limited movement beyond low-income respondents, and this may reflect our study protocol, which is we have a large percentage of crack-using population, which is a very low-income population. Our study sites are located in the very poor neighborhoods, therefore it's very difficult to get higher income individuals to come into those neighborhoods. And also we have one standard of compensation where our compensation is appropriate for the low-income individuals that we're getting. However, if we increase that, to recruit more middle-income individuals, it may be considered coercive for the low-income individuals that we're recruiting. And also one other thing to be mindful of is recruitment can move into concentrated homogeneous networks like shelters where your recruitment coupons are being circulated in a small homogeneous group. But this requires a larger sample size for RDS. So RDS essentially is efficient in recruiting our target populations. That's what we've seen, which are IDUs, non-injection drug users, men who have sex with men and women, and sex partners in general. We found that equilibrium was achieved quickly for major demographic variables. However, it is less efficient in recruiting, we're seeing that it's less efficient in recruiting non-drug using sex partners and higher income individuals, which are common problems in other forms of recruitment for drug-related studies as well. And the last point I want to make about RDS is that the study participants and the staff are strangers. And while we as study staff or researchers are essentially evaluating our population based upon their behaviors or their risk behaviors essentially, they're also evaluating us. With respondent-driven sampling, we have to remember that these individuals are in turn going out and recommending an individual that they know to come into our study. So it is very important that our staff are very knowledgeable of the study population, of the neighborhood in which they serve, because, again, we have to pass a test for these individuals to let them know that their information is being protected, that we are there for their best interest, and that the study staff can identify with them and on some level. And it is essential for screening, as I mentioned earlier, and this can increase your population, your community participation. So, thank you very much.
All right, I'd like to thank all the presenters for really very interesting talks, and open it up now for questions. Yes, in the front.
About the YTTR study, and I was wondering how you were able to avoid, you talk a lot about the social desirability bias, but how you're sort of able to can hear me without the mic. Can everybody hear?
Well, what we do is when girls are recruited, we go fully through the screening process. And what happens is I wouldn't say it's an extremely long consent, but with the consent, we do go through everything they get, all the compensation for being in a study, and we do let them know they're being tested for two things. One, an STD screen, and two, to detect whether or not they've had sex when you recruit, again, it could be up to 3 months from when you consented. And to be honest, I think a lot of participants trust us to know that everything's confidential. And when they do go and do the swab for the YCPCR, we haven't had any concerns or complaints with doing the swabs. And girls have voiced concerns in the past. We do also pregnancy testing. With this one, we don't do pregnancy testing. But we have had girls who are vocal enough to let us know if they have concerns. So we haven't had any issues with consent with the YC. So it's actually been pretty easy to slide it right into our protocol with girls. Yes. That they report. The question was, how does it affect when girls are one being tested for the YCPCR and within a matter of an hour are asked to report on that? I personally don't know that it fully affects how they report based on the YCPCR. If that's affecting their number, because I don't know that any would inflate it or vary it based on that.
Yes.
I don't know the direct cost, but I can check and I can give you that information and just how it's been to add that to our study. But again, Jonathan Fiddleman, we ship all of our labs off to their lab, and they've come up. Since we started doing the test, they've actually improved their system for testing and have been able to have a much faster turnaround. But I can get you that information afterwards. Yeah.
In the back in the brown?
Yes.
Actually, sexual compulsivity is a term that is used to describe sexual addiction. So it's pretty much the same construct, just people call it by a variety of names. So out of control sexual behavior, sexual addiction, sexual compulsivity. And the second part of your question was, how did it relate? Yeah. Okay.
Yes, way in the back. Can you repeat the question again?
No, those are tested positives, but we didn't actually find equilibrium on all demographic variables right away. On gender, we found it at all of our sites almost immediately. But on race, for example, it fluctuated dramatically over time, and in fact continued to fluctuate even in the outer waves. And so there's a lot of analysis that we have to do to try to figure out why it is that we were seeing that kind of instability, particularly in both Los Angeles and Chicago. It appeared actually that it might have been related to very short chains of recruitment for Hispanics as opposed to African Americans. And so what we found was that our percentages of, it looked like we reached stability early on for African Americans and Hispanics, and all of a sudden Hispanics dropped out and African American chains continued on and grew in proportion. And so because of the differential size of the recruitment chains by race, it's very difficult to interpret what is stability.
Okay. And I think, you didn't raise your hand the second time. Yes, in the front.
Dr. Riccio, the data that you presented, the number It's the raw data, but when we did adjustments to account for the recruitment bias, the numbers changed very little for virtually all of our variables, including HIV, where it might have changed by maybe 1%. I think it accurately reflects the very low-income individuals in those cities, yes. And I think what's also interesting is when you start looking at those individuals in particular, a large portion of them appear to have been reached by treatment resources. For example, if you hear Steve Shaptos talk later tomorrow, he talks about how the viral loads were very low. In most of those who were HIV positive, and that most appeared to be on medication. So it appears that the treatment networks were extending into this low-income population quite successfully.
Yes.
The seeds were drug-using individuals as well. Some of them were MSMs also. And we, essentially using our field staff, who were very knowledgeable of the community and of the population, we identified individuals who we thought would be successful seeds, essentially, that they had they had networks and they were vocal and they were able to go out and recruit and willing to go out and recruit other individuals. As for the networks, if I had it up again, I could show you where they were all distinctly, those three networks were distinctly mutually exclusive. So there were no connections with the other two networks.
But how did you know that? It was all anonymous, right?
Well, we have the coupons. It's based upon the coupons that we give them. So that diagram I gave you was based upon the coupons that the individual entered into the study with. So we have those by serial number, and we can link them by serial number.
But you're right. We can't know if there are connections that are not reported by you. I mean, the bigger issue is that once you get out past six or seven waves, you start getting into what we think of in network theory as the sort of giant component of the larger sampling space, where their distance from each other is within 6 degrees of freedom.
Mm-hmm. On the map that you showed,
they were the color of the coupon that the individual entered into the study with.
No,
by site. Oh, those were just the different colors for the different sites.
And
so
but there were dots on the map.
Yes.
Were those the people recruited close to those sites?
Yes. Well, those were the people who interviewed at those sites. So they did their interview at the site, say the southeast site. However, their residence was, as you saw, all over the city of Chicago, but concentrated in those neighborhoods.
Okay, I'd like to again thank our presenters for a great session.